Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island Beer Company, brewing and barrel-aging craft beer since 1988. More at gooseisland.com. We don't need to be the only beer you drink. We just want to be the best beer you drink.
This is Sound Opinions, and later on in the show, we are going to talk to one of our discoveries from the South by Southwest Music Conference, She-Devils. But first, we've got punk in 1977.
That is the immortal Cretan Hop by the boundlessly influential New York punk band, the Ramones. Greg, I'm smiling. It makes me smile every time I hear it, even after all these years. You're grinning, too. Last week, we kicked off our examination of 1977, the year punk broke. We were revisiting these episodes with a look at punk in the UK and how the sound of the music and the attitude in the music world changed. You can find that episode at soundopinions.org. Today, we're going to revisit the other side of the ocean, what was happening in 1977 in New York, which is really where it all started. Punk began to hit the mainstream in a big way, not in terms of sales, but at least in terms of people looking at it.
That's right, Jim. And to help us explore New York in 77, we spoke with music journalist Ira Robbins. He was there at the ground floor of this movement, the founder and editor of Trouser Press, a magazine I read religiously in the day for all my news about what was happening in punk. So Ira's in the scene when it was happening, and we started our conversation by asking if he felt the music was being appreciated outside of New York.
If I could just roll back the clock a little bit, I think what makes 1977 interesting in New York is that there was also a 1975 in New York, because unlike London, New York had a pretty solid scene in the same genre for a couple of years before anyone took notice of it. You know, whereas London kind of exploded overnight, New York in 1975 had Blondie, the Ramones, Heartbreakers, Talking Heads, Wayne County, the Dictators, Patti Smith, the Shirts, and all these other bands, so that 1975 was pretty much the same as 1977 as far as the New York club scene. Overarching sense that any of us that went to those shows had was that this was a scene that was never going to go anywhere. You know, we loved what we had, but it was the same couple hundred people that went to all the shows. It wasn't growing, especially. The bands that got signed to small independent labels, by and large, that, you know, didn't really have high hopes for them. And, you know, with a couple of extraordinary exceptions, proved that to be true.
That's fascinating because we look back on it now and we think, oh, it was this great flowering. But you're right. I mean, being a punk rocker then, being sort of on the outside, it certainly wasn't widely accepted nationally. But the CBGB's thing, obviously the scene coalesced around the Lower East Side. What else was happening in terms of the club scene there? You know, in terms
of Max's had been, you know, preceded CB's, you know, and Max's had kind of the older crowd, you know, the Bowie, Dolls, Lou Reed, Velvets, kind
Warhol.
And Max's was a really bizarre place. I mean, you know, Springsteen played Max's and Bob Marley played Max's and Patti Smith kind of lived there for a while, you know, but there was also the Club 82, which was a lesbian transvestite bar downstairs on, I think, 2nd Street, which was a pretty scary place. And, you know, you kind of had to take your heterosexual teenaged angst in hand to go there. And then there was this huge place in Queens called Coventry. They had two stages, and I saw one show there with the Dictators on one side and the Dolls on the other. Now, this is all way before 77.
Now, Ira, you have a New Yorker's perspective on this, because what I think distinguishes 77 is that this is when the rest of America catches on.
Mm-hmm.
These records finally are filtering out to the rest of the country. But before we quit the CBGB scene, a word about the fashion. When you look at pictures of that club today, people are dressed really casually.
Mm-hmm.
They look like college students. I mean, you didn't see the spiky haircuts and mohawks you saw in London.
No. New York had a couple of different scenes going on at the same time, as every big city does. I mean, when the Dolls started, the Dolls fell right into the glam rock world. They were the center of an audience that was also going to see Roxy Music and David Bowie and T-Rex. And when we went to those shows, we dressed up like crazy.
Well, we can't take her this way. And her friends don't want another spring. Hoping for a
it wasn't punk rock by any stretch of the imagination. It was glam rock. We all wore stacked heels, and we all wore, you know, like great shirts and, you know, great jackets. By 76, 77, it was much more functional. I mean, it was, you know, CB's was never an event show. You went to see a band you liked.
What is CBGB's to you? It's a local club. I live a few blocks away. I come free because I'm privileged, you know? So I come to see my favorite band. Good band, you know, it's an open forum, you know?
Well, I think the biggest fashion statement was the Ramones with the matching leather jackets and the ripped jeans. I know the guys in Talking Heads and television were like wearing collared shirts and things like that on stage. It wasn't any big deal in terms of a fashion statement, right?
No, I mean, people were really at that moment still trying to be iconoclastic. There really wasn't a fashion to follow. You know, the bands were all different. The lifestyles of the bands were all different. You know, I mean, the television were, you know, sort of pretentious French intellectuals in their heads, you know, whereas the Ramones were, you know, street kids from Queens. I think everyone kind of went their own way for a few minutes.
Proven. This is a fact. Confidential.
All right, wait a minute. Before we get too nostalgic, let's remember a few things about New York in this period. The city is bankrupt. Crime is rampant. Rats are running up and down the streets of the Lower East Side. There's the Son of Sam killings. All it takes is a blackout, and suddenly New York City is the third world.
And there were thousands of others who took to the streets to plunder and to pillage. Over 2,500 looters and vandals arrested during the first 8 hours of the blackout. The looters concentrated on small businesses, mostly in the poorer sections of the city, where unemployment and crime are chronically high.
How did that atmosphere factor into things?
New Yorkers, there's an expression that some New Yorkers have used. I don't know if it's broadly enough used to actually have entered the vocabulary, but we used to call it a grim smirk. In other words, it was a grimace and a smirk at the same time. And it was the understanding that life sucked and it wasn't necessarily going to get better, but so what? You know, we'll get through it. And it's kind of a joke anyway. And I think if there's a punk ethos that could be distilled down to a facial tick, it's that. And I think that was perfect for 1977. I mean, those bands were saying, it's bad out there. We're going to have some fun. And I don't think it was any deeper than that or any more profound than that. You know, going to First Avenue in the Lower East Side, which is where, actually where I was born in the 70s, was terrifying. It was like going to CBGB's was like taking your life in your hands as far as, you know, my sheltered little white boy experience was concerned. I went there, you know, gulping, you know, and hoped I would get home at the end of it.
Well, let's go through these records. Now, the Ramones actually had two records come out in 1977, and the debut came out in 76, and it was just mind-blowing to the people who heard it. I remember when a kid in my dorm in college brought it to us. For 2 weeks, we played it as a comedy record, and then the second week, we were like, wait a minute, no, this is really good. And then in 77, they come out with Leave Home and then Rocket to Russia, the third album, the big commercial breakthrough, if you will. But let's talk about the Ramones a little bit. What was the perception of them in New York City?
They were familiar. They were popular. You know, they drew a crowd. I remember the first time I saw them, I hated them. You know, they can't play. And where's the minor chord in Warm California Sun? You know, and it's just like all that kind of stuff. And it was basically my old school Eric Clapton is God mindset being insulted by the stripped down basicness of what the Ramones did. I mean, we thought the Ramones were funny, actually. I mean, you know, to your point about thinking they were a comedy act, I mean, we used to make fun of Joey, the way he stood on stage. We used to call him the Salamander because he would kind of, kind of wrap himself around a mic stand. You know, the next time I went to see them, I loved them and never changed that opinion. And those three records, you know, are like the cornerstone of an entire generation of music.
Yeah, it is hard to separate those four. They are kind of a piece.
Absolutely. You know, but the other thing that I would add to this is that, again, and I hate to be the prequel guy here, but, you know, the Dictators had started several years earlier. The Dictators' sensibility of that kind of pop culture garbage, take drugs, have fun, be stupid, puke on the floor, That was there for a couple of years before the Ramones came along. And I have to say that in a small sense, you know, the Ramones felt like they were picking up that cudgel. The idea that a rock song could be perfectly obnoxious while being enormously fun was kind of a new idea that the Dictators pioneered, and I think the Ramones carried forward, you know, much more efficiently.
D-U-M-B, everyone's a kid's a man.
We'll be right back with more of our talk about New York punk in 1977 with music critic and journalist Ira Robbins. Later, we'll talk with the Canadian duo She-Devils. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.